Welcome to Musinomics. I'm Larry Miller from the Music Business Program at NYU Steinhardt. In a 2002 interview with the New York Times, the late David Bowie predicted that we would eventually treat music like running water or electricity, in that we would pay for access rather than ownership, driven by the broad availability of new technology. Bowie was right, and 21 years later, streaming dominates music consumption. On this episode of Musinomics, we visit with Howie Singer and Bill Rosenblatt, who are friends of the pod and professors in the NYU Music Business Program, where they both teach classes in data analysis in the music industry. They've co-authored a new book, Key Changes, The 10 Times Technology Transformed the Music Industry, published by Oxford University Press. It's about how technology has affected the music industry through a series of 10 disruptions that have taken place over the past century. And while the technologies themselves have evolved over the decades, the changes within the business follow a distinct pattern. So, Howie and Bill, how'd the book come about?
Well, it was something I had thought about for a long time because you and I, Larry, lived through some of these changes, pre-Napster even, and what the industry had been through. And then I worked at Warner Music through the eras of iTunes and streaming. So I lived through all of that. But as I thought about it and what I might want to write about it, I realized there was a much longer story to tell about the technical disruptions in the music industry from the very beginnings of the business.
And Bill, how'd you come to this?
Well, so Howie and I have known each other, not for as long as the two of you have known each other, but for pretty long. It's going on 20 years now. And one thing that Howie knew about me is that I have worked in the book publishing industry and written books. And so during that summer of 2020, the lockdown summer, Howie came to me and said, I have an idea for a textbook. And like probably millions of other people at that time, I was thinking about writing another book myself. And Howie told me his idea, and I thought, you know, this is a much more interesting idea than anything that I've thought about. And so I said to Howie, A, nobody writes textbooks anymore. B, this would be a great mass market trade book topic, meaning a book that you buy in a bookstore as opposed to a course a book. And then C, would you like any help? And he said yes.
When we think about transformation in the music business, we tend to think about like the big digital disruption, the Napster moment. And although I do want to talk about the Napster moment, in thinking about how technology has impacted the music business, well, that story goes back a little further than that, doesn't it?
It does. One of the things that Bill and I talk about with the book is that there's this view that the industry was perking along and Napster came and blew it up. I mean, today we're talking about, is AI a Napster moment for the industry? It's become a phrase that we talk about. And certainly, you know, the industry was caught somewhat flat-footed and moved slowly, mostly because they were making so much money with the CDs. But that sort of is a theme, that until the times get tough, the music industry really doesn't move to the new thing. Mm. The music industry has lived on formats since it began, going back to discs versus cylinders and radio and vinyl and, you know, the 8-track versus the cassette. And it is a constant story of the industry being reluctant to move, as any business is when things are going well. When the money's rolling in, it's hard for the incumbents to make a change. And we see that lesson again and again. Yes, when digital downloading was first proposed, and you and I, Larry, were among the ones proposing it in the mid to late 90s, the industry was happy to stick with CDs and all the profits that were rolling in to fund, you know, enormous salaries and destruction of hotel rooms and drugs. But when Napster hit and the industry revenues declined, they made a move. And, you know, that's no different than what's come before.
The other thing to note is that there have been a bunch of books out that basically said the music industry was humming along fine until Napster came along and blew it up. And yes, that is what happened, but except for the humming along fine part, which we take issue with, and that turned out to be the elevator pitch of our book to publishers, the idea that, no, there were actually several disruptions, and some of them are quite severe. You think of Napster, the industry lost, depending on whether you count for inflation or not, 50-60% of its value in a very short period of time. there were similar moments throughout the past century that were almost as severe in terms of the disruptive factor.
You, as a really concise way of explaining and really telling the story of the evolution of the various transformations in the music industry, you developed a framework that you call the 6C framework. So let's talk about that in the context of the beginning of recorded music.
So when we were first thinking about the book, having some way to tell this story for each of the formats was important, to have a consistent way to do it, another C. Mm-hmm. And it was always the case that the technology came first. Sometimes the technologies came together and flopped. They never became a mass market product. Mm. But when they did become mass market, and it's typically not one technology, people talk about the Napster piece of software as the seminal moment. But of course, if there weren't high-speed networks at universities to support that software, it wouldn't have taken off the way that it did. And, you know, if we hadn't had iPhones.
Mobile apps and mobile broadband and cheap camera technology, you wouldn't have YouTube.
Right. So it's always the case that there's multiple technologies. But once that gets in place, the rest of the business has to deal with the aftershocks of that earthquake event, of this new format coming in. And the other parts of the business get affected, and here we had to get creative in names for the C's, were the creators, the artists. They change what they create to maximize their profit, to fit the best with this new format.
To exploit the creative possibilities, the artistic possibilities.
Creators are one, consumers is another. Not the best word for fans, but it does start with C, so we used it. But the fans often, particularly young people, jump first to the new format. It often has to do with a new kind of music, a new genre that's being picked up. The distribution channels change. They have to adjust. They had to figure out, how do I put CDs in a rack that used to fit vinyl albums when the CD came out? And they invented the long box, one of the most ecologically unfriendly packaging tools ever. And how do we make money with this new format? What's the business model? And certainly the world of streaming represents a drastic change, but we can go back to the phonograph. There was no model when the phonograph was invented. And, you know, was Enrico Caruso going to get paid royalties or a flat rate for making his recordings?
When cassettes came out, the music industry wanted to collect a tax, essentially, given the fact that the cassette was so amenable to home taping. They tried really hard for that, and actually even harder in the UK, and that failed. But that was a disruption that took place because of this format that made it easy for just everyday people to record albums at home.
So I think we've covered all the C's save one, which is usually the last one to change, which is copyright. Mm. So the law moves ever more slowly, although one could argue that the world of downloading, the lawsuits against Napster sort of came first before there was a real business with Apple and iTunes. So we found, when we were writing the book, thinking through each format change and these C's gave us a way to structure the story of each format. The order wasn't always the same. The things we had to say weren't the same. But as you go through the book, you revisit these topics. And it also gave us a way to think about how things extend across time. You know, how do the creators change over the course of all these formats as opposed to just one by one?
Going back almost a century, there was a nascent recorded music business in the 1920s, and then comes the Great Depression. That was a pretty big disruption. Can you describe what was happening then and what came after?
Well, there's a one-word answer to that, and it's an answer that you know well, Larry, and the word is radio. Radio, of course, started out in the 20s, pretty much during the Depression, was the time when you could actually buy a single box that you could plug in the wall and get a radio signal to play in your living room or whatever. And for the first several years, you were not encouraged to play recorded music on the radio to transmit it.
In other words, if you were a commercial broadcaster, you were not encouraged to play music, because why?
Well, you were encouraged to play live music, and there was quite a bit of live music on the radio, but the musicians' union didn't like it. The music publishers didn't like it. They thought it was a way of sort of free riding on music recordings. And so the Commerce Department and then the FCC would slow down your approval of your radio station if you played recorded music on the air, and the means for playing recorded music on the air was extremely primitive. You had a phonograph with a horn and a microphone stuck in front of it, and that was your playing recorded music on the air. And this is the way it was for quite a long time, actually.
But it's worth noting, as big as the drops we just focused on for Napster, the drop in recorded music revenues, record sales, was something like 90% when the Depression hit. And along came a product that you lost something that you had with a phonograph. You lost the ability to choose what disc you were going to put on and listen to. You had to listen to what the radio station played. But you got one box. And then after that, if you were a consumer, the music was free. This was a great deal. And that helped to make radio the mass market product that it was, because you bought it once and now you had music forever that you didn't have to pay for one at a time. And that greatly depressed record sales. It in part led to the invention of the jukebox to try and find a way to boost record sales with somebody during the Depression years.
How did then the recorded music business recover itself in the years between the Great Depression and, say, the end of World War II, when we had the rise of, you know, big bands and singers out front like Sinatra? How did it go from losing 90% of the revenue in the early 30s to something like recovery? Not so long after.
The industry actually did take a nosedive after World War II, but for unrelated reasons. Basically, there was a format war between the new vinyl formats, the 7-inch single and the 12-inch LP, and that just confused people, and they all said, you know, the heck with this, we're just going to go listen to radio again. But there's another disruptive force that caused some changes, and that was television. So when television came out, the FCC started to lighten up on its regulations and allow more recorded music to be played. And one could argue, and has been argued, that this served as a promotional effect for record sales. You'd hear it on the radio, and then you'd go buy the record at the local record store.
Yeah. And there was something else, which was the technology of the radio allowed the creation of phonographs that were based on electricity. They weren't clockwork mechanisms that you had to wind that had no volume control. People would literally stick a sock in the horn of the gramophone to play it lower or close the door on their Victrola when it was a case of a piece of furniture. But when the electronics of the radio got incorporated into the phonograph, it made for a more desirable product, not just because it was friendlier to the consumer to use for things like volume, but it enabled certain artists who would never have been popular on the older acoustic phonographs. They were all belters. They were Al Jolson singing into the horn or Enrico Caruso again, who could perform at that level. Suddenly, Bing Crosby, who of course was a very popular radio star, could croon into an electric microphone and create a recording that captured that essence much better than any of the more primitive phonographs were able to. And so there were new artists and new singers and new kinds of music that encouraged people who could afford it. Admittedly, it was still slow during the Depression, but who could afford it to buy records that featured this new group of artists and genres of music.
In my reading of the book, some big themes emerge. One of them is that convenience and price always beat quality. We can go back almost a century and keep learning that lesson over and over and over again. Where have we observed that maybe more recently?
Well, my favorite example of that is what happened to the cassette, to bring up the cassette again, because at the time, cassettes were introduced around 1963 as a convenient voice recording dictation kind of medium. You had reel-to-reel tape. Reel-to-reel tape was a consumer format. It was never very popular, but it was an audiophile format, closest perhaps to the studio master, even closer than vinyl, according to some people. And then you had the 8-track, which was an evolution of the cart from radio studios that I'm sure you're familiar with. You just shove it in and press a button, and that's all you do. But the cassette was just so convenient. It was half the size of an 8-track. You could stick it in your pocket. It was designed on purpose to be stuck in pockets by Philips. So convenience kind of led the way into getting innovators to think about how do we make this a better medium for music. And so there were two innovations that happened right around the same time. One was the chromium dioxide tape formulation, and the other was Dolby noise reduction. So Ray Dolby came out with the noise reduction technology that we now know today. And there was a man named Henry Kloss, who to hi-fi aficionados is sort of a legend. He's the guy who first put those two pieces together and created a cassette deck that used chrome tapes and Dolby noise reduction. And this was the Advent 201, which came out in the early 70s. And if you know anything about hi-fi equipment, you think of Advent, you think of speakers. I had Advent speakers. But Howie, who's the cooler kid, had the Advent tape deck, which is kind of like a cult classic kind of thing. And so it came out. It was a huge deal in the hi-fi industry and the hi-fi press. And that everyone was saying, this is a cassette deck that sounds as good as reel-to-reel. Now cassettes are a hi-fi medium. Later on, Nakamichi, the Japanese company, put out this thing called the Nakamichi 1000, which is an extreme high-end, ultra-luxury audiophile product that sounded as good as any reel-to-reel deck. And so everyone thought, oh, cassettes can be good quality. And then as usual in consumer electronics, these features filter down into the lower priced products. And then once you get to the late 1970s or even mid-1970s, you've got midline cassette decks that can make, if you set the knobs correctly and so on, can make copies of albums that sound pretty much indistinguishable from the original LPs. And so that was a way in which technological innovation was brought to bear to make convenience win out over the arguably superior quality of reel-to-reel or vinyl.
Fast forward to the very early 1980s, and we have the launch of the CD as a commercial format, along with the promise of perfect sound forever. Not exactly?
Not exactly, right.
But certainly convenient to people. I mean, one of the things, we don't think about it much today because we're all used to shuffle on our playlists, but the fact that you could easily access any of the tracks on a CD was a real positive. Consumers could never do that. You had to be a good DJ like you are, Larry, to drop the needle, right? You had to be good at dropping the needle at the right spot.
That's right.
But that convenience of, they were harder to break, certainly, than vinyl records. They held up longer over time. They didn't degrade the more times that you played them. So there were lots and lots of reasons. You could stick them in your car. You could never really make a record player in the car. Radios worked, but there was no on-demand music in the car until we got to cassettes. And even then, if many were 8-tracks, again, you couldn't really select which song you wanted to play. So the CD gave a lot of control to the consumer. And most importantly, the consumer was convinced the sound was better. Whether the audiophiles thought so or not, people like me went out and rebought their vinyl collection on CD, which between the new records that were coming out for the first time on CD during that era of the biggest stars, whether that was, you know, Michael Jackson or Madonna, whoever we want to focus on, as well as rebuying what you already owned, you know, whether that was the Beatles or the Rolling Stones, those two combined drove the industry to enormous heights that we have not seen since.
And it's also arguable that another feature, if you're a record label, or bug, if you're a consumer of the CD, is the fact that you couldn't duplicate them easily. I'm using the past tense here because eventually you could, but for quite a while after the introduction of the CD in the early 80s, you couldn't. And, you know, the record industry designed this in reaction to the ease with which people could record cassettes. And so the sales pitch was, here's this nice portable format. It's almost as small as the CD. Almost as small as the cassette. It sounds better. It's more durable. It's not going to get all clogged up in your car player. And, you know, the pitch then was that the perfect sound forever, it's going to last quite a long time, which we now know is not quite as true as we used to think it is. But the lack of recordability was definitely part of the formula that the record companies had in mind when they chose to work with this format.
So the Napster disruption happens, and then streaming. And I guess the question now, in this context of talking about all of the physical formats that preceded it, are we now in the post replacement of your library era, given that there are, what, 140 million tracks up on the major streaming services today, and pretty much everything is on demand.
I think we are, and I think that is a big factor in what's driving this consumption of catalog, right? There's many articles have been written over the past year or two that the percentage of listening on the streaming services is driven more by catalog, frequently what they define as shallow catalog, meaning more recent stuff. And perhaps no artist exemplifies this more than Taylor Swift. But Taylor Swift, in particular, by re-recording her albums, which she did for different economic reasons, but she is certainly, fit right into this strategy or, scenario that's been going on that, when an artist comes out with a new record, even if the record is not as good as the fans like, it reminds them of how much they used to love this artist. And they go listen to the shallow catalog of the last record and the one before. And Spotify even suggests songs when when the playlist ends, they put up an X song. You can have that feature. And it is often one of the older songs from that artist. So it sort of feeds into this. I have all the songs at my fingertips. And if I happen to hear something on the radio on the way home, or I happen to see an artist on, now we can see him on late night TV again, or Saturday Night Live soon, it reminds me how much I like them, and I'll go back and listen to the older stuff, which is not ancient stuff necessarily, simply the previous 3-4 releases. And by having that, we're seeing this consumption go up for somewhat older material.
There's also something else going on. The whole vinyl renaissance thing has led to this idea that that real fans like having multiple ways to consume music, that have different experiences, and buying things that happen to be recordings but are also useful for other purposes. So one of the most amazing statistics that came out last year in the Luminate end of year study was that 50% of vinyl buyers don't own turntables. Mm-hmm. And I think I heard that the number is even higher in the UK. 60%, 55%, something like that. That's remarkable. But, I have a daughter in college, and her roommate last year had albums on the wall of the dorm room just for display purposes. And I don't know whether she listened to them or not, but that's certainly something that you can do with albums, LPs, because the covers can be great designs and have been, for a very long time, iconic album cover designs. And so you have that functionality and that sort of tacticality that you don't get with streaming. And there is an appetite for that type of consumption that I think has grown independently of the whole streaming scene. I think vinyl is kind of plateauing now, but it's plateauing at a place where, especially if you count used, which of course the record industry doesn't, you're up at 12, 15% of revenue. It's remarkable how significant that is now.
We can't really have a conversation about the music industry in late 2023 without talking about generative AI. What is next? Where do we go from here?
We don't know. If we did know, then maybe we wouldn't be sitting here. We'd be out, getting rich or something. But one thing that I like to focus on, and Howie's going to have other thoughts on this, is the ease with which music can be generated and distributed to the public. This is a real inflection point, just like there have been many other inflection points in how easy it is to create music and distribute them. There was the four-track cassette deck in the 1980s, and then, of course, digital sampling later on, and all kinds of inflation, and of course, back in the 1950s, the tape recorder, as opposed to disc cutting setups, they're all inflection points. So you mentioned 140 million or so tracks on the streaming libraries now. There was an AI startup, and I can't remember the name right now, that said, we have just doubled the amount of music that's available by creating 100 million distinct music tracks. That doesn't mean they submitted them to Spotify, but that's possible to do, and it's certainly going to accelerate the rate of music that's available to the public. Generative AI is going to make that volume increase more, and so that begs the question, is Spotify and are all the other streaming services just going to keep accepting all those submissions, or are they going to say uncle at some point and figure out some other way of being rather than just we're going to take everything that everyone sends us. So I think that's an interesting thing that's going to happen, and we'll see how that plays out.
Well, we do know what Universal Music Group, among others, thinks about everybody being on the same tier, that maybe there should be at least a couple of different tiers over which music is distributed, discovered, consumed, and ultimately the creators and their investors compensated.
I think that we already see a bunch of uses that hold promise for the fans, for the creators. Spotify announced that they're translating podcasts using AI into other languages. Let's go with Beyonce rather than Taylor Swift this time. If you wanted to have, you know, a version of the Beyonce movie that's going to come out and it was sung in Beyonce's voice, but in Japanese for the Japanese market, you could do that. If you wanted to take a song that could do better if it had a more Latin flavor, could you easily change the genre by adding different instrumentation to the song using AI? All those things are possible. The question is, will that be done with the permission of the artist or without the permission of the artist? And as soon as you say permission, that implies a license, that implies potentially compensation for the artist. And that's the big debate. The tech companies say, training AI models on any voice you want, whether that's Beyonce or your voice as a voiceover actor, Larry, is just fine. I don't need permission. It's fair use. And we already have writers suing. We have actors suing. There haven't been any suits in the music industry yet. But again, based on the history, I think Bill and I would both give pretty high odds.
It's inevitable.
That's as high an odd as you can give.
The book is Key Changes, The 10 Times Technology Transformed the Music Industry. Howie Singer, Bill Rosenblatt, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Larry.
Thank you so much.
The Musonomics Podcast is produced by Musonomics LLC, strategy consulting and analytics for and about the music industry. Technical and audio production this episode from Disheep Garg, with editorial production by Joseph Vella for the NYU Steinhardt Music Business Program. Our theme music is by Piotr Garbisonik. If you like what you heard on this episode of Musonomics, please give us a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. It only takes a minute, and it's so important in helping new listeners find our show. Follow us on X, formerly known as Twitter, at Musonomics. From the Music Business Program at NYU Steinhardt, I'm Larry Miller. Thanks for listening.